This is an ABC podcast.
Fatalofa to Maloni and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. As always, we acknowledge that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, with only less than a month before elections in the Solomon Islands, how will the PM fare this round? Fiji government still sticking with controversial policing agreement with China. And what's it like being a diplomat in a small Pacific country? We'll find out more on these stories coming up on the show. And if you miss any of what we've shared today, go on online, type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine and you can listen back to our program. We'd love for you to share these stories across all your social media platforms and feel free to visit our ABC Pacific Facebook and Instagram pages. Like and follow for all the latest stories from across the Pacific. I'm Aggie the Bowl and this is Pacific Beat. Vanuatu went through three prime ministers in as many months last year. Now, the country has entered into a period of political calm, but for how long is the question on everyone's mind? The big test for the government is a referendum in May on a new law to tie MPs down to political parties. So, joining us this morning to talk more about the referendum is Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Shalo Salwai. With that, I say good morning, Prime Minister.
Good morning.
Morning. Thank you for joining us this morning. I want to get straight into it. What exactly will Nivans be asked when they participate in this referendum on May 29th?
So there's two questions with the amendment of the Constitution, 17A and 17B. One, because it's a requirement of the Constitution, if we have amendment of electoral system or parliamentary system, we have to go to a referendum. So the two questions is related to independence or and even within the political parties, as if anyone is moving out of political parties, then the executive of the political party may recommend to the speaker to vacate the seats. The other one is about independent MPs or those coming from custom movements, because custom movements sometimes it's only respective to one island or one village, or it's always one seat. So it's a requirement as well. Well, it's part of the amendment of the Constitution on 17B, that after 2 weeks following the election, they have to join a political party. This is the two main things that people have to say yes or no. As we consider that it is the main source of political instability some years back, more than 20 years now, that we are facing political instability in the country.
Prime Minister, can you just clarify, because we've got reports here, you've just said it. They have to choose within 2 weeks a political party, but we've got reports here saying that it's they have within at least 3 months of being elected, yes?
Yes, after the election, 2 weeks after, the independent MPs or even those running for custom movements or representing the custom movements, they have to decide to join a political party. It's a requirement of the Constitution. And but after referendum, we gave them three months to decide to join a referendum. But after the referendum pass, when elections after, it's a requirement after each election, it provides 2 weeks to decide to join a political party.
Thank you for that. Now, Prime Minister, why do you think, though, this referendum itself is so important to the political future there of Vanuatu? I mean, why a referendum? Do you think this is the best way to address the political instability?
Well, we went through many series back of political instability back in 1996, if I recall well. But and we come up with many version, many proposals, and I think this one maybe it's not really the best, but it can be an option to address the political instability in the country. And we have to go through the referendum because it's a requirement of the constitution, as provided in Article 86, to consult people. If we have to amend the parliamentary system or electoral system, and here is the case, because we have the legislations on the electoral, and but also parliamentary system. So we have to go back to the people to decide.
And of course, you know, with the changes within government, with the leaders that have come through, you are now the Prime Minister. You have really, I suppose, managed to bring some calm to the political chaos in Vanuatu. How have you managed to keep it under control?
Well, this time is a transitional period as we agree together to pass the budget, but also to pass the amendment of the constitution. And it is the case. So now we are going back to the people to decide. The 52 members of parliament, and I think it's it is historical. It is not easy to get the two-thirds of the members of parliament to decide on the amendment of the constitution. But it's a special occasion last year when we come to, again, a series of changes of the government. Within 12 months, we have to change the government 3 times. And we have to decide. So the 52 members decided on what the government is proposing to the parliament. So we decide unanimously to vote for this amendment. And now we have to go back to the people now to decide. But people also requested in many occasions. They are tired of political instability. They also present the petitions to the government and to the parliament. I was one of those who received the petition. So it was also expressed by the people, and government listened to them. Government bring it to the parliament, and the 52 members listen to what the people is asking. So now we're going back again to the people to decide once and for all through a referendum.
And noticeably, Prime Minister, with some of the issues that I'm going to get into that have happened there in Vanuatu, you weren't actually present at last year's Pacific Island Forum. Last year, you weren't present at the Pacific Island Forum because I know you were focused on trying to help your constituency recover from the devastation by Cyclone Lola. I'm wondering, how has that recovery response been since then?
Well, we're still waiting on the recovery because you know that we have a series of cyclones that hit my constituency. The first one was back in 2020, this year on. Then last year we got two, Kevin and Julie. And by at the end of the year, we have Lola again. So it's a great damage because on top of what Aaron destroyed, we have two cyclones and Lola again. So it just destroyed what remained. And it is hard to come up with some plan. I can understand the role of the Ministry of the Climate Change, because we cannot expect the next cyclone. Now we are in the season of the cyclones, but it is a clear proof that now a cyclone can come at any time. Lola is an example. He came outside the normal season of the cyclone, so. Some few recovery are now in the way, but we recover what, according to the report of the TC Aaron, but not Lola, not yet Lola. It's taking time. As we have to assess, we have to find funds as well for the reconstruction, for the recovery of especially government public institutions like schools, health centers, or dispensaries. So very important ones.
And the funds that were promised to those that were affected, have they actually received those necessary funds to help with recovery? And as we talk about the cyclone season, do you believe Vanuatu is possibly better prepared if you were to face another cyclone disaster?
Well, I think our people are get used now on cyclones. So we have less casualties in the when you compared to the past cyclones, compared to Palm, compared to Uma. There's less casualties. That means we understand we can find ways to hide during the cyclone. But it doesn't mean that they have better houses or resident houses. It doesn't mean that. But they manage to hide. With friends and families, but they have a more strong and resilient home. I believe we have fun, but with the process we have in place and the weather that continue to be a big challenge in the country, it is hard to shift the materials. I understand that some process have already been done, went to the tender boat. They decide on the enterprise to rebuild some classrooms, but it is delayed because of the weather. We have to ship the material from Santo and Port Vila, and we continue to face bad weather, and it is also delaying the recovery. And even at home, back in the islands, in the constituencies, we are also facing the same problem because it continues to rain. As I'm speaking, it's more than 2 weeks now that it is raining in whole Vanuatu. So it doesn't allow to progress with recovery.
Thank you for that, Prime Minister. If you've just joined us here on Pacific Beat, I'm your host, Agi Dubol. I'm speaking to Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Shalo Salwai. Prime Minister, I want to take our conversation towards, you know, Vanuatu being a tourism country, but the country's national airline itself has been in a bit of turmoil. What do you think you could do to help fix those problems there at Air Vanuatu?
We have a series of meetings yesterday with the board and the CEO, the acting CEO, and government should decide on some measures soon about Air Vanuatu. But what it is more important now is to bring the tourists back, is to address the airports of Port Vila, Barfield, and the other one in Santo, because well, we want to get more tourists in the country, but Vanuatu is an issue. But the airport as well is a challenge, and we experienced it back in during the Palm when Barfield was really affected and damaged, and we were cut from the world, rest of the world. So it is important today, and government is working on it, how to address the two main airport at human entry, which is Barfield and Pequa and Santo. As we are vulnerable to the disaster, it is good to have a backup airport in the country. So it is not only Air Vanuatu. I know that Air Vanuatu is also contributing, but we can allow other airlines to come to Vanuatu. But I think one of the main challenges is the airport that we have in the country, and we need to, government has to work on the two main airports to allow bigger plane to as well to come to Vanuatu.
Will the government though approve further funding though for Air Vanuatu's new planes? This comes of course after it diverted recent approved funds towards supporting the airline's liability payments.
We have to decide. Government is not really a good businessman, but Council of Ministers and the shareholders has to decide whether we'll continue with the same structure of the company, but it's owned 100% by the government. And we experience it with similar arrangement in other sectors. So I think the government has to decide whether it will continue to be 100% shares or to be party or have only some shares in the company. So it's a decision that has to be taken by the shareholders and the Council of Ministers as well.
Finally, I have to ask, Prime Minister, I know Australia and Vanuatu have signed a security treaty. Would like to know, what is the status of this agreement at the moment? Will Vanuatu's parliament ratify it?
Well, it is yet, and many of us didn't see it, this agreement, so we need to see it, and we need a wide consultation before it can go to the parliament, and everyone has to agree on it. We have to make sure that it is a similar arrangement is also be done with other development partners, as we are an online movement. We want to be friends with everyone.
I thank you for that, Prime Minister. I appreciate your time this morning. We thank you for coming on the show and sharing what is the latest there within the government, and all the best for the elections later in May.
Thank you.
That, of course, is Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Shalo Salwai, here on Pacific Beat. Pacific Beat. It's less than a month before the people of Solomon Islands head to the polls for an election many see as the most important in its history. After 5 years of rapid change, including a controversial pivot towards China, Prime Minister Manas Etsongavare has been touring the country, drumming up support for his future vision. But there are challenges, and they see a very different future for the country. The ABC Solomon Islands reporter Krishnarita Almanuliong is following the campaign.
United! United!
If Peter Kenilorea Jr. gets his way, it's what Solomon Islanders will be in the mood for in next month's national election. In opposition since 2019, Kenilorea Jr. wants the top job. And watching on at his party's campaign launch in Solomon Islands' capital, Honiara, were what's viewed as his secret weapon. Young people.
He's real. He's got integrity. He's not a liar.
He thinks about the issues that affect us. School fees and looking after young people.
The son of the nation's first Prime Minister, many see Kenilorea Jr. as the only real rival to Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manas Etsongavare. And in a country where 70% of the population is under 35 years old, Kenilorea's campaign is focusing on health, education and youth issues.
The party does not believe that our development partners will be the saviour of Solomon Islands.
Standing in his way is the incumbent Manas Etsongavare.
We register this country now on map because of powerful decisions, important decisions that you're making. We become relevant.
Manas Etsongavare is in his fourth stint as Prime Minister, and he wants a fifth. His latest term has been dominated by one decision, switching allegiance from Taiwan to China. It triggered a wave of events, most notably riots in Honiara in 2021 and the signing of a secretive security deal with China. In a campaign speech late last week, Mr. Etsongavare praised the Chinese Communist Party's governing style and questioned the merits of democracy.
Which for the last 45 years...
For the past 45 years, we have been struggling to make headway in development under the present arrangement. Even the opposition leader admits China is here to stay.
No previous Solomon Islands Prime Minister has gone to an election and re-emerged as the leader. Yet, most political watchers expect Etsongavare to make history and win the April 17th elections.
If he is back in power, It's only because he has a following that he commands and that puts him up there.
Solomon Islands academic Dr. David Gegeo believes the Sogavare's storied history as a deft political operator puts him in the box seat. He says this was shown last year when Sogavare rode a wave of national pride after the country hosted the 2023 Pacific Games. Its centerpiece being a $120 million new national stadium funded by China. But it's a country with high rates of poverty and a health system on its knees, prompting questions about the Prime Minister's priorities.
But I'm sort of a humanitarian. I mean, I'd rather see that our human daily needs, basic needs are met.
Peter Kenilore Jr. offers an alternative path for the country, one he hopes voters choose.
The burden of developing Solomon Islands rests squarely on the shoulders of the government and people of Solomon Islands themselves.
The ABC has made repeated requests to interview Prime Minister Sogavare.
And that report from ABC's Chris Narita Almanu Leong.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
To Fiji, where the government has announced its intention to stick with a controversial policing agreement with China. Signed in 2011, it allowed for intelligence sharing and police training between the two countries. The agreement drew criticism in 2017 when more than 70 Chinese nationals, alleged to be cyber criminals, were arrested in Fiji, frog-marched onto a plane and flown back to China without appearing in a local court. It prompted Fiji Prime Minister Sitiveni Rampuka to call for review of the agreement when he came into office. I spoke earlier with Fiji's Home Affairs Minister, Pio Digotuntua. Why has the government decided to stick with this policing cooperation agreement with China?
When we had to reassess our agreements with China, including public security and defence, we had to look at what was there on the table by the previous administration and whether it would still be relevant to continue. After 12 months of having a look at that, we have decided that we would continue. But we have also included some other aspects of it, particularly this MOU, you know, at least twice a year to come and sit down every 6 months to determine whether the MOU is still relevant given the changing security landscape.
And so can you maybe explain to us then what the benefit it does have to or for Fiji?
Yeah, I think what is there already in terms of how we should work for each other continues to capture, I think, the relevance of the relationship that we share. So we have not really changed drastically. It's not perfect. I don't think there is ever any perfect understanding, but it's something that we all work at continually. Obviously, it's based on mutual respect and also recognition of each other's integrity, you know, as a state.
Minister, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe you've publicly said that your government has decided not to sort of embed Chinese police among Fiji police. Why is that?
Under the memorandum of agreement, we can decide in terms of the areas where we agree those things that we want to do initially. On this occasion, we are concentrating, learning from each other, particularly with regards to education. So we have agreed that we will now send some of our senior police officers to study in China and also to look at certain areas where we can build a specialized capability for our police. So I can assure you that we have asked the Chinese if they can help us out with some of those mobile scare ones that will help our police to monitor, you know, law and order within our remote communities.
Minister, if you don't mind, can you actually maybe take us through some of those provisions of this policing deal with China?
Yeah, I think it's relevant to any of the other provisions, security arrangements that we have with Australia and New Zealand. One area that we were concerned with at the beginning and which was the subject of our review is in the areas of intelligence sharing. We would like to review that in terms of what we necessarily have to share. I cannot go into the detail, but that is an important area. We need to look at the laws that will guide the implementation of this MOU. It does perhaps complement the area of having respect for each other, understanding that all we want is to help the area, particularly the capability within our own government to look after the people in the areas of internal security and law and order. So we would like to see how the MOU is going to complement that.
Even with all of those, with a review, though, has the government made any other changes to the agreement?
No, we have not. Except that we have within certain provisions that will allow us to look at this MOU every so often.
Well, the Prime Minister himself, Sitiveni Rambuka, is yet to comment publicly on this agreement. So do you think he agrees with the decision to continue with the arrangement? I mean, has he actually endorsed this deal?
We have spoken before I came. That is the agreement that we have reached as well previously, well before I went to China. We will continue with the MOU. We will continue to review it as we go along. And I'm glad the Prime Minister has endorsed it. And I believe he has also communicated that to his own counterpart within China. I had communicated our decision to continue with the agreement to the state councillor from China when I met with him, or perhaps the minister responsible for public security in Beijing.
Were traditional partners consulted as part of this review, or is this purely just an internal thing for Fiji?
Oh, this is Fiji's integral issue. But at the same time, we have a very, very comprehensive agreements with Australia, New Zealand, the United States in terms of law and order. You know, we have no enemies. We work with everyone for our betterment. We respect each other's sovereignty and integrity, and that is the basis on how we deal with each other. You know, Fiji will not be pushed over. We are not an agent for any particular power. We work with everyone, particularly for whatever is, you know, that will benefit, particularly Fiji and, you know, in the region as well in maintaining peace. And we want to continue to do that with all of our partners in that regard.
These are often times of heightened strategic competition agreements like this. Do you ever think that it may cause a little bit of unease in Canberra, Washington and Wellington, as you say?
Any decision is a cause for effect. There is no decision that has no effect on anybody, both locally and internationally and regionally. I must add, though, that we respect all of our, particularly our traditional partners in Australia, New Zealand, the US. You know, we are a democratic nation. We aspire to democratic principles. At the same time, there are things to learn with everyone else. We are not selling ourselves short to anybody. We work at the way and how we keep Fiji, the region, and the world free of trouble. In Fiji, we have this big problem, you know, with drugs in particular. We need every assistance that we can get to help Fiji and our community. And if we need to go to China to clean Fiji of this problem, then we will do it. But we do it with people and nations who respect us as an equal partner. That's the guiding principle of our relationship with everyone else. And I want to assure our Fijian people that government does this in the interest not only of Fiji, but also in the interest of the region.
In Parliament, you know, you even flagged the drug problem that the country is dealing with. So really, how can this arrangement help combat the drug issue there in Fiji?
The Chinese deal with drugs, you know, using their own laws in a very particular way. You know, our laws are different. We respect our own laws. There are experiences that our police can learn from theirs, whilst understanding that there are only certain things that we can do under our laws. But you need to learn from everybody. Two or more brains is better than one. So if you can pick the best of, you know, Chinese and US brain and Australian brains, why not? The problem is still a Fijian one.
I want to take us back to 2017, Minister. You know, we saw pictures of Chinese police deporting about 70 Chinese nationals in masks on board a plane under this arrangement. Are we likely to maybe see a repeat of this?
Well, at this stage, like I said, our relationship is based on mutual respect. If the Chinese see it fit that they would request us to do similar things for Chinese fugitives or whatnot that are in Fiji, is something that we have to discuss with the Chinese at the time. The means and ways would have to be consistent with Fijian principles and Fijian laws.
Well, you're in Japan right now for talks with the Japan defence leaders. Wondering, is there a need for Japan to maybe have that military and security presence in the region?
This is a Japanese question. That's a question that Japan needs to pose on itself. I think it's a continual transformative agenda in Japan. They're looking at themselves going forward, the whole security landscape, the strategic landscape, the geopolitical competition. They will need to decide what they want. They've eased up a little bit that now that they are participating in UN missions. However, they posture themselves in the region through security and defense is something they must decide, and for the rest of the region to either to accept or reject. Japan has been traditionally a partner in development. And they've been that way in a big way to Fiji and the Pacific also.
But if they were to have a presence in the Pacific, would you back that presence in the Pacific? Because I would say that's probably would be the first time since World War II, right?
Yeah, it's not a simple question in that regard. It would also depend on what is the nature of how they want to exist in the region. We have Japanese self-defense services visiting ships. You know, we have military personnel coming in to visit. They have, you know, defense arrangements with every, you know, the greater powers of around the region. Those things we have to sit down and decide. When those things do come to the fore, there is no need to look at it now because that is something that the Japanese have to decide and how we will behave.
I do want to switch the conversation for a bit. Knowing that former Prime Minister Waringa Bainimarama and suspended Commissioner of Police Sitiveni Kiriho were found guilty and convicted. So I'm wondering, do you think Kiriho will be terminated or not be Police Commissioner now that he has been convicted?
The process of their conviction is a process of the law. It is something that is independent to my political portfolio. The matter of the police commissioner is a matter of the Constitutional Officers Commission. They are the ones that are running the current tribunals and all that against Ngilio. In fact, now that he has been convicted by the High Court, they have to decide his future. If they decide that he is no longer possible for him legally to become the commissioner given this current situation, then I will take my cue from that.
And that is Pio Tikonduadua, Fiji's Home Affairs Minister. Up next, it's News Wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It is that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines with our news wrap brought to us by producer Mackenzie Smith. I'd like to say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Maggie.
All right, we'll get into it. Fiji's in for more bad weather today.
Yeah, unfortunately, heavy rain warning remains in place for the entire country with all schools in Fiji closed today. There are also widespread road closures in the north. The government says landslides have disrupted some electricity and water supplies, and it's also urging people not to attempt to cross flooded rivers, roads, streams and crossings. The Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, has asked non-essential public servants to consider working from home today, and a trough of low pressure is expected to remain over Fiji for the next few days.
Thank you for that. And I believe in other Fiji news, though, the embattled Minister for Women, Linda Tapuia, she is facing travel restrictions. Why is that?
Yeah, so just for context, Linda Tapuia was stripped of her deputy leadership of the People's Alliance Party earlier this month following allegations of a sex and drug scandal. Since then, she's managed to retain her ministerial portfolio. However, the Fiji Times reports that the Prime Minister recently stopped Tapuia from travelling to New York to attend the 68th session on the Commission on the Status of Women. Prime Minister Rambuka reportedly said this was because of the ongoing issues relating to Tapuia.
To the Federated States of Micronesia, though, the US, they're planning a major airport upgrade.
Yeah, so this is taking place on the island of Yap, where Benar News reports the US Air Force plans to spend $400 million on making the international airport there military capable. According to a budget request submitted to Congress, the upgrades are needed because the US lacks defense sites to conduct training in the Pacific region. This comes just weeks after US President Joe Biden passed critical funding for the Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, and the Marshall Islands as part of the Compact of Free Association Agreements.
Goodness, a lot is happening around the Pacific. As always, Mackenzie, thank you for joining us this morning.
No worries.
That is Mackenzie Smith with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Sounds like a program I need to tune into. Ending the continuing fuel crisis in Papua New Guinea remains a work in progress, although the government says it's finding a solution. For now, many citizens remain uncertain about where their fuel will come from. PNG reporter Belinda Cora hit the streets of Port Moresby to find out how its citizens are surviving.
On any given day, a trip to the fuel station remains unpredictable. Many residents queue up for a long time just to try and get petrol or diesel. While the government continues to assure Papua New Guineans it is doing something about the continued fuel crisis in PNG, some citizens are still not convinced. Freda Tarelulu owns an Uber business in Port Moresby, transporting mainly women to and from work each day. She says on top of the rising cost of living, Papua New Guinea's fuel shortage is another headache.
Every day, we have to dig deeper into our pockets to, you know, refuel. 50 kina at 11 litres, that's not enough for a day. And with this Puma outlets closure, we have to stand in really long lines at Mobil to get fuel.
Papua New Guinea has been in the grips of a crippling fuel shortage for the past month, with the main supplier Puma Energy firstly not operating and now operating at a reduced capacity. It follows similar shortages in the last 2 years, and stocks have been rationed in recent months. Some supply has started to trickle through again, but business owners like Frida Tarululu are still worried.
They have to come out with what the real problem is and what the real issue is. They have to at least source fuel. If they say that they're going to source fuel from outside, they have to get that in as soon as possible. What's the holdup here?
The issue itself stems from the long-running dispute between Puma Energy and PNG's Central Bank, Bank of Papua New Guinea, over its foreign exchange orders. Last year, Bank South Pacific announced it was closing Puma Energy's accounts, with the fuel supplier now also using the much smaller PNG bank, Kina Bank. Prime Minister James Marape's cabinet has the Essential Services Act to allow the government to requisition major assets to shore up supply. It's also directed the Central Bank and BSP to continue financial services to Puma Energy. For Shadow Minister for Petroleum, Energy and International Trade and Investment, Karenga Kua, it's not the solution.
But in the process, it's going to destroy Bank of Papua New Guinea, and it's going to destroy BSP Bank. And because Kina Bank is wanting to become entangled, even Kina will be destroyed. So we need to make it clear to Puma that it needs to organize an orderly exit. Sell the business, get as much money as it can from the sale and leave, and then the operations will be continued by any third party who have the appetite to continue under the existing climate.
Mr. Kua believes there's another way, and continuing with Puma is not it.
The other solution is that when I was in cabinet, we had already approved a plan for MRDC in partnership with ExxonMobil to build an alternative import infrastructure system in Port Moresby. Land was already made available at Kanudi to MRDC, which was formerly owned by PNG Power. And MRDC and Exxon are already in the process of building that alternative supply system.
In his last press conference speaking on the issue, Prime Minister James Marape said there's a need to end the near monopoly that Puma Energy has on fuel suppliers in the country. He appointed his deputy John Rosso to oversee the introduction of further competition. As it stands, Puma Energy is the monopoly supplier of aviation fuel.
I want to also indicate that in the medium term, through this, we will enact laws. When we come back to Parliament in May, we'll pass certain laws that will reduce the monopoly of fuel supply and will open up the market. And this cabinet also has allowed for Kumul Petroleum Holdings Limited to be our national energy company that will work with subsidiaries in our country for the importation of fuel and for redistribution of fuel in our country.
But the uncertainty over fuel supply has been dragging on for months. Those hit hard in the National Capital District during these shortages include business owners who say they've had to dig deeper into their pockets just to make ends meet each day. Mr. Olulu, who also has children who go to school, says she wants the government to be clearer about what their permanent solution is to put her mind and others at ease.
It's really frustrating, you know, as a small business owner, we have to, and also not for me only, but other citizens as well.
And that's small business owner Frida Taolulu, ending that report by Belinda Cora. What's it like being a diplomat in a small Pacific country? Well, thanks to geopolitics and intense competition for influence, it can be tricky business. That's why a new generation of Pacific diplomats are being trained up on how to operate in an increasingly difficult environment. The program is sponsored by the New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and its participants could one day play a big part in maintaining the stability of the region. Carl Evans has the story.
The most significant agreement between Australia and a Pacific Island nation ever.
Handshakes, ribbon cutting, cheesy photos, that's what we the public see when countries strike a diplomatic agreement. What we don't see is the work that went on behind the scenes, work done by diplomats, meetings and conversations that serve as the bridge between nations.
We can all see that the world is getting somewhat more disrupted and uncertain. Even in the digital age, actual live diplomacy based on people-to-people relationships and relationships of trust is more and more important.
Rosemary Banks is New Zealand's former Deputy High Commissioner to the Solomon Islands and Australia. She's heading up a new diplomatic training program for young Pacific diplomats from Papua New Guinea, Fiji and Vanuatu, who will go on to serve in their country's foreign service. More than 30 participants took part in the five-week program, which wrapped up this month. Another is scheduled for April and will feature participants from a wider area.
We'll talk about the skills that you need or the way that you should approach when you have to brief your minister or you have to brief your secretary of foreign affairs, how to deal with a difficult meeting with a representative from another country, how to conduct yourself and behave at an official function like a reception, which people think are, you know, for enjoying yourself and having a nibble and a nice glass of wine, but of course they're actually for getting your work done and finding the right people and expanding your network of contacts. So all of these tradecraft skills, if we might call them that, they will have initial training on.
So what kinds of skills do they teach? Well, they're quite vast, particularly in the digital age, but ultimately they boil down to one thing, forging good relationships, which can be easier said than done.
We might ask them to split into pairs, for example, and one person is pretending to be a diplomat from another country and, you know, the other person is the home country diplomat, and they'll have a difficult issue that they're expected to discuss and work out between them. Or, for example, a lot of people find it quite difficult to work out how to circulate in a big reception, how to get the most out of it, how to meet people, how to interrupt somebody else's conversation. So we will have a networking reception, which is set up precisely as an opportunity for the participants to practice introducing themselves to people they don't know, initiating conversation, finding out points of common interest or work interests that they can connect with.
Elias Geramo is one of the participants. He hopes to use his newfound skills to generate more investment into PNG and create jobs for young people.
We need the necessary infrastructures, facilities, so we can, you know, convert those resources into monetary value to them. Economic diplomacy. I'm interested in economic diplomacy as to how I converse or dialogue with partners to bring them investors into the country. That's my interest and passion.
Elias says good diplomacy is the best way to find a solution to the issues that threaten the Pacific, the biggest of which is climate change. But experts say other threats are closing in. Deputy Director of Strategic Engagement at the Pacific Security College, Dr. Henry Ivarachure, says the next generation of Pacific diplomats will face a tougher job than any who came before them.
I don't want to be a diplomat now.
It won't be easy. It will get very complicated, and there are too many complexities to manage. There will be too many actors in region, and the numbers will be increasing. So their relationship and their ability to manage those relationships will become really complicated. And, you know, they have traditional partners that they have to care about and maintain those relationships. And then they have to deal with additional players. And so I see, you know, in the future, new agreements coming into place, new security agreements coming into place.
Dr. Ivarachure expects geopolitical pressure from China and the US to increase in the coming years. Meanwhile, law and order issues in PNG, as well as cybersecurity and an unresolved push for independence in Bougainville, West Papua and New Caledonia could create instability as well.
When we have this politics of China trying to influence Pacific Island countries to switch diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and the possibility of investing corrupt practices to try and persuade our countries to switch allegiance. So that could potentially have an impact on their foreign policy behaviour.
But there's a silver lining. With everyone seemingly wanting a piece of the Pacific, Dr. Ivarachure says the interest will give diplomats leverage to get the best outcomes for their country.
And one thing that we've got to remember is this geopolitics has given agency to Pacific Island countries. And they have to be able to exercise their agency sensitively and ensure that they actually benefit from the agency. The Pacific, everybody now wants to get into the Pacific, and they have to learn how to work those relationships, maintain their traditional relationships, work with the new parties that are coming in, and really look at all the bilateral agreements that they have and see how they can benefit.
And that was Deputy Director of Strategic Engagement at ANU's Pacific Security College, Dr. Henry Ivarachure, ending the report by Carl Evans. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Charlotte Sunway, is hoping a referendum on a new law to tie MPs down to political parties will bring political stability to his country.
And now we have to go back to the people now to decide. But people also requested in many occasions. We are tired of political instability.
And that's Vanuatu's Prime Minister, Shalo Salwai. You can find those top stories on our website. Simply type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. Remember, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time, but we'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned because your news is next, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily with Michael Chow and Jacob McQuire. I'm Aggie Dubois, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat.